Chapter 1. Rumi. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the water. It is a way I have of driving off the stream on a regular basis. Whenever I find myself going green by the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November day or so, whenever I find myself involuntarily bringing up the rear of every human flagpole, and especially whenever my high horse gets large enough to handle me that it requires a strong balance to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the sky. This is my substitute for history. With a philosophical flourish, Plato throws himself into the stream. There is nothing surprising. If they but knew it, almost all men would sound the tongue that shows the mountain. There now is your insular city of the mountains, belted round by wars as Indian islands by gold. Commerce surrounds it with her surf. Right and left is the ship. Its extreme downside is the battery, where that noble mole is washed by waves and cooled by breezes that a few hours previous were out of sight. Look at the crowds of water gazers there. Circumnambulate the city of a dreamy Sabbath afternoon. Go from Corlea's Hook to Corinthe's Slip, and from thence by Whitehall. What do you see? Posted like silent sentinels all around the town, stand thousands upon thousands of messengers fixed in ocean revels. Some leaning against the spile, some seated upon the pierheads, some looking over the bulwarks and ships from China, some high aloft in the rigging as if striving to get a still better seaworthy view. But here are all of weekdays pent up in teeth and platters, tied to counters, nailed to benches, clinched to death. How then is this? Are the green fields gone? What do they hear? But look, there come more crowds pacing straight for the water and seemingly bound for a dive. Strange. Nothing will content them but the extremest gloom. Loitering under the shady lee of yonder warehouse will not suffice. No. They must get just as nigh the water as they possibly can without falling in. And there they stand, miles away, and windless. Inlanders all, they come from lanes and avenues, north, east, south, and west. And here they all unite. Tell me, does the magnetic virtue of the needles of the compasses of all those ships attract them hither? Once more. Say you are in the country, in some high land of lakes. Take almost any path you please, and 10 to 1 it carries you down in a dale and leaves you there by the pool in the stream. There is magic in it. Let the most absent-minded of men be plunged in his deepest reveries. Stand that man on his legs, set his feet going, and he will infallibly lead you to water, if water there be in all that region. Should you ever be athirst in the great American desert, try this experiment if your caravan seems to be supplied with a metaphysical professor. Yes, as everyone knows, meditation and water are wedded forever. But here is an artist who desires to paint you the dreamiest, shadiest, quietest, most enchanting bit of romantic landscape in all the valley of the Saco. What is the chief element he employs? There stand his tree, with the hollow trunk as if the hermit and the crucifix were within. And here sleeps his meadow, and there sleep his cattle. And up from yonder cottage goes a sleepy smoke. Deep into distant woodlands wind reaching the overlapping spurs of mountains and the hillside below. But though the creature lies thus tranced, and though this green tree shakes down its sides like a wolf, all the wind as the shepherds drop of water they are. Were Niagara like a cataract of sand, would you travel 1,000 miles to see? Why did the poor poet of Tennessee have suddenly seen two handfuls of silver? Didn't the poor poet have hoped that he sent and invest his money just on a trip to Rockwell Beach? Why is almost every robust country boy with a robust country suddenly a prince to go to see? Why, upon your first voyage as a passenger, did you yourself feel such a mystical sensation? Your first moment that you and your ship were now out of sight of land. Why did the old Persians hold the sea holy? Why did the Greeks give it a separate deity and own brother of Jove? Surely, all this is not without meaning. And still deeper the meaning of that story of Narcissus. For because he could not grasp the tormenting, mild image he saw in the fountain, plunged into it, and was drowned. But that same image, we ourselves see in all rivers and oceans. It is the image of the unwatchable fantasy of life. And this is the truth. Now, when I say that I'm going to see whenever I begin to grow hazy about the eyes and begin to be overconscious of my lungs, I do not mean to have it inferred that I ever go to see as a passenger. For to go as a passenger, you must needs have a purse. And a purse is but a passenger unless you have something in it. Besides, passengers get seasick, grow quarrelsome, don't sleep, do not enjoy themselves much as a general thing. No, I never go as a passenger. Nor though I am somebody of a sort, do I ever go to sea as a commodore or a captain or a cook. I abandon the glory and distinction of such offices. For my part, I abominate all honorable and respectable toils, trials, and tribulations of every kind whatsoever. It is quite as much as I can do to take care of myself without taking care of ships, barks, rigs, schooners, and whatnot. And as for going as cook, though I confess there is considerable glory in that, a cook being a sort of officer on shipboard, yet somehow I never fancied broiling fowls. Though once broiled, judiciously buttered, and judgmatically salted and peppered, there is no one who will speak more respectfully, not to say reverentially, of a broiled fowl than I will. It is out of the idolatrous dotings of the old Egyptians upon broiled ibis and roasted river horse that you see the mummies of those creatures in their huge bakehouses appearing. No, when I go to sea, I go as a simple sailor, right before the mast, running down into the forecastle, aloft there to the royal masthead. True, they rather order me about some, and make me jump from spar to spar like a grasshopper in a May meadow. And at first this sort of thing is unpleasant enough. It touches one's sense of honor, particularly if you come from an old established family in the land. The Van Rensselaers or any of the Hobbit Inns. And more than all, if just previous putting the Hobbit into the top box, you have been lording it in the country schoolmaster, making the tallest boy stand in the air. The transition from a schoolmaster to a sailor, and requires a strong concentration of sympathy and distinction. One of some old hunks and sometimes order to down whatever. What does that indignity amount to wave out from the scales of the Nautilus? You think the archangel thinks anything the less of me because I promptly in the sky obeyed my old hunks at that particular instant? Well then, however the old sea captain may order me up, however they may come from me, a again, I always go to see as a sailor because they make a point of paying me for my trouble. Whereas they never pay passengers a single penny that I ever paid. On the contrary, passengers themselves must pay. There's all the difference in the world between paying and being paid. The act of paying is perhaps the most uncomfortable infliction that the two orchard thieves impaled upon us. But being, what will compare? The urbane activity with which a man receives money is really marvelous, considering that we so earnestly believe money to be the root of all earthly ills, and that on no account can a moneyed man enter heaven. How cheerfully we consign ourselves to perdition. Finally, I always go to sea as a sailor because of the wholesome and pure air of the forecastle. For, as in this world, headwinds are far more prevalent than we believe, that is, if you never violate the Pythagorean theorem, so, for the most part, the Commodore on the quarterdeck gets his atmosphere from the sailors on the forecastle. He thinks he breathes it first, but not so. In the same way, do the commonality lead their leaders in many ways, at the same time, leaders little suspected. But wherefore it was that, after having repeatedly smelt the sea of a different sail, I could now take it into my head to go on a whaling trip. This, the invisible police officer of the faith, who has the constant surveillance of me and secretly dogs me to seek me in some unaccountable way, and doubtless my going on this whaling voyage formed part of the grand program of Providence that was drawn up a long time ago. It came in as a sort of brief interlude and solo between more expensive performances. I take it that this part of the bill must have run something like this. Grand contested election for the presidency of the United States. Whaling voyage by one detail. Bloody battle in Afghanistan. Though I cannot tell why it was exactly that those stage managers, the Fates, put me down for this shabby part of a whaling voyage, when others were set down for magnificent parts in high tragedies, and short and easy parts in gentle comedies, and jolly parts in farces, though I cannot tell why this was exactly. Yet, now that I recall all the circumstances, I think I can see a little into the springs and motives, which, being cunningly presented to me under various disguises, induced me to set about performing the part I did. Besides, the delusion that it was a choice, resulting from my own unbiased free will and discriminating judgment. Chief among these motives was the overwhelming power of the great whale himself. Such a portentous and mysterious monster. Then the wild and distant sea, the undeliverable nameless powers, if all the helped to sway me to my passion. With other people, such things would not have been inducements, but as for me, I am tormented with an everlasting itch. I love to sail forbidden seas. Saturday night in December. Much was I disappointed. delighted upon learning that the little packet for Nantucket had already sailed, and that no way of reaching that place would be until the following Monday. As most young candidates, the pains and penalties of whaling stop at this stage to embark on their voyage, it may as well be related that I, for one, had no idea of so doing. For my mind was made up to sail in no other than a Nantucket craft, because there was a fine, boisterous something about every section of the famous old island in the sea. Besides, though New Bedford was gradually monopolizing the business of whaling, and though in this latter quarrel Nantucket is now much behind her, yet Nantucket was the original, the Tyre of this the place where the first dead American whale was stranded. Where else but from Nantucket did those aboriginal whalemen, the Redmen, first sally out in canoes to chase to the Leviathan? And where but from Nantucket did the first adventurous little sloop put forth, partly laden with imported cobblestones, so goes the story, to throw at the whales, in order to discover when they were nigh enough to risk a harpoon from the bowsprit? Now, having a night, a day, and still another night following before me in New Bedford, ere I could embark for my destined port, it became a matter of concernment where I was to eat and sleep meanwhile. It was a very dubious-looking, nay, a very dark and dismal night, bitingly cold and cheerless. I knew no one in the place. With anxious grapnels, I had sounded my pocket and only brought up a few pieces of silver. So, wherever you go, Ishmael, said I to myself, as I stood in the middle of a dreary street, shouldering my fan, and comparing the gloom towards the north with the darkness towards the south, wherever in your wisdom you may conclude to lodge for the night, my dear Ishmael, be sure to inquire the price, and don't be too particular. With halting steps, I paced the street and passed the sign of the crossed harpoon. But it looked too expensive and further on, from the bright red windows of the Swordfish Inn, there came such fervent rain that it seemed to melt the packed snow and ice from before the house. For everywhere else you could hear fog about 10 inches thick. Rather nearly to me when I struck my foot against the bridge, because from hard remorseless service, the soles of my boots were almost new. Too expensive. And hear the sounds of the tinkling glasses within. But go on, Ishmael. Please don't you creep. Get away from before the door. Your patched boots are stopping the way. So on. I now by instinct find myself. For there darkness where the future is. Moving on, I at last came to a dim sort of forest. in the docks and heard a forlorn creature, and looking up saw a swinging sign over the door with a white painting upon it faintly representing a tall, straight and these words underneath: "The Spouter King, Peter Coffin." Possibly Spouter? Rather ominous for that particular person, thought I. But it is a common name in Kentucky. I suppose this Peter here is an emigrant from there. As the light looked so dim, and the place for the time looked horrible, and the dilapidated little wooden house itself looked as if it might have been carted here from the ruins of some burnt district, and as the swinging sign had a poverty-stricken sort of creak to it, I thought that here was the very spot for cheap lodgings, and the best of tea coffee. It was a queer sort of place, a gable-ended old house, one side palsied, as it were, and leaning over sand. It stood on a sharp, bleak corner, where that tempestuous wind, Euroclydon, kept up a worse howling than ever it did about poor Paul's tossed craft. Euroclydon, nevertheless, is a mighty pleasant zephyr to anyone indoors, with his feet on the hob, quietly toasting for bed. In judging of that tempestuous wind, Euroclydon, says an old writer, of whose works I possess the only copy extant, it maketh a marvelous difference whether thou lookest out at it from a glass window where the frost is all on the outside, or whether thou observest it from that sand window where the frost is on both sides, and of which the white death is the only thing. Sure enough, thought I, this passage came to my mind. Old black metal windows. Yes, these eyes are windows. And this body of mine is the house. What a pity they didn't stop up the chink and thrust in a little limb. But it's too late to make any improvements now. The chips were carted off in their house. Poor Lazarus there, chattering his teeth against the curbstone. He might plug up both ears with rags and put a corn cob in his mouth, and yet that would be a tremendous what a fine Lazarus rather be in Sumatra than here? Would he not farther lengthwise along the line of the equator? Yea, these gods go down to the fiery pit itself in order to keep out this cold. Now that Lazarus should lie stranded there on the curbstone before the door of dimes, this is more wonderful than that an iceberg should be moored in one of the Moluccas. Yet Dives himself, he too lives like a czar in the ice, made of frozen size, and being a president of a temperance society, he only drinks the tepid tears of orphans. But no more of this blubbering now. We are going a-whaling. There is plenty yet to come. Let us scrape the ice off the feet and see what sort of place this fountain may be. The Spouter Inn. Entering that gable-ended Spouter Inn, you found yourself in a wide, with old-fashioned wainscoting, reminding one of the bullocks of some condemned old craft. On one side hung a very large oil painting, so thoroughly besmoked that every wave displaced, that in the unequal cross-lights by which we could only by diligent study and a series of systematic visits to it, and careful inquiry of the neighbors, that you could any way arrive at understanding of its purpose. Such unaccountable masses of shades and shadows, that at first you almost thought some ambitious young artist in the time of the New England and endeavored to delineate chaos bewitched. But by dint of much and earnest contemplation and oft-repeated ponderings, and especially by throwing open the little window towards the back of the entry, you at last come to the conclusion that such an idea, however wild it might not be, altogether unwarranted. But what puzzled and confounded you was a long, limber, portentous black mass of something hovering in the center of the picture, over three blue, dim, perpendicular lines floating in nameless yeast. A boggy, soggy, squishy picture, truly. Enough to drive a nervous man distracted. Yet was there a sort of infinite, half-attained, unimaginable sublimity that fairly froze you to it, till you involuntarily took an oath with yourself to find out what that marvel meant. Ever and anon, a bright, but alas, deceptive idea would dart you through. It rang sea in a midnight gale. It's the unnatural combat of the four primal elements. It's a blast of heat. It's a hyperborean winter scene. It's the breaking up of the icebound stream of time. But at last, all these fancies yield to one portentous something. That once found out in all the world, does it not bear a faint resemblance to a gigantic fish? Even the great without the fish. In fact, the artist's designs, by the theory of my own partner based upon the aggregate opinions of many aged persons with whom I converse on this subject, the picture represents a Cape Horn in a great hurricane. The half foundered ship weltering there with its three dismantled masts, and an exasperating roar purposing to spring leading up over the world, engaged in the enormous act of impending destruction of all the three monsters. The opposite world is some were thickly set with black open swords. Others were tufted with knots of human hair. The one was suffocating with a vast sweeping around like the segment made in the new mown grass by a long armed mower. You can wonder what monstrous insects could ever have gone a death harvesting with such a hacking, horrifying terror. Mixed with these were rusty old whaling lances and harpoons all broken and deformed. Some were storied weapons, with this once long lance now wildly elbowed. 50 years ago, the great sea killed 15 whales between a sunrise and a sunset. And that harpoon, so like a corkscrew now, was flung in javelin sea and run away with by a whale years afterwards, slain on the tree of life. The original iron entered nigh the tail, and like a restless needle sojourning in the body of a man, traveled a full 40 feet, and at last was found in the crossing this and on through yon low arched way, cut through one of the great central chimneys with fireplaces all around, you enter the public room. A still dusty room with such low, ponderous windows above and such old wrinkled planks beneath that you would almost fancy a few flounces or cracks, cockpits, especially of such a howling when this corner-painted old arch rock so furiously. On one side stood a long, low, shelf-like table covered with cracked glass pieces filled with dusty rarities gathered from this wide-ranging nook. Projecting from the further angle of the room stands a dark-looking den, the bar, a rude attempt at a right whale's head. Be that how it may, there stands the vast, arched bone of the whale's jaw, so wide a coach might almost drive beneath it. Within are shiny shelves ranged round with old decanters, bottles, flasks. And in those jaws of sweet destruction, like another cursed Jonah, by which name they call him, bustles a little withered old man, who for their money dearly sells the sailors deliriums pours his poison. Though true cylinders without. Within, the villainous green goblin glasses deceitfully taper downwards to a cheating bottom. Parallel meridians rudely pressed into the glass surround these footpath goblets. Still to this mark, Kindred charges but a penny, to this a penny more, and so on to the full glass. The Cape Horn measure, which you may gulp down for a shilling. Upon entering the place, I found a number of young seamen gathered about a table, examining, by a dim light, battered specimens of shrimp. I sought the landlord, and telling him I desired to be accommodated to the room, received for answer that his house was not a bed unoccupied.
What is that?
He added, tapping. You ain't no objections to sharing a hot beneath a blanket, have you? I suppose you are going away, and so on. Pretty good use to that sort of thing. I told him that I never liked to speak to you, that if I should ever do so, it would depend upon who the hunter might be, and that if he, the landlord, really had no other reason, the hunter was not decided to objection. Why, rather than wander further about a strange town and so difficult, I would put up with that.
Aaron,
Lotus topers newly landed from sea, and they began capering about most breathlessly. I observed, however, that one of them held a knife, and though he seemed desirous not to spoil the hilarity of his shipmate by his own decision, yet upon the whole he was trying to make as much noise as the rest. This man he stood full 6 feet in height, with noble shoulders and a chest like a cofferdam. His face was deeply brown and dark, making his white teeth dark. While in the deep shadows of the darkness, from his fine stature, I thought he must be one of those towering men of the world. When the reverend mounted at its height, this man was unobserved, and I saw no more of him. He became my comrade on the sea. In a few minutes, however, he was lured by the sea, and being, it seems, for some reason, a huge boat with them, they raised the cry of "Bulkington! Bulkington! Where's Bulkington?" and darted out of the house in pursuit of him. It was now about 9 o'clock, and the room seeming almost supernaturally quiet after these orders, I began to congratulate myself upon a little plan that had occurred to me just previous to the sea. No man prefers to sleep here in bed. In fact, you would a good deal rather not sleep here in bed. I don't know how it is, but people like to be private when they're sleeping. And when it comes to sleeping with an unknown stranger, in a strange house, and that stranger a harpooner, then you're objecting. Nor was there any earthly reason why I, the sailor, should sleep too in a bed, more than anybody else. For sailors no more sleep too in a bed at sea than back to sea to a shore. To be sure, they all sleep together in their apartments, but you have your own hammock, and cover yourself with your own blanket, and sleep in your own skin. The more I pondered over this harpooner, the more I abominated the thought of sleeping. It was fair to presume that being a harpooner, his linen or woolen would not be of the tidiest, certainly none of the finest. I began to twitch all over. Besides, it was just me, and my decent harpooner ought to be home and going to bed. Suppose now he should tumble in upon me as usual. How could I tell from what vile hole he had been coming? Landlord, I've changed my mind about that harpooner. I shan't sleep with him. I'll try the bench here. Just as you please. I'm sorry I can't spare you a tablecloth for a mattress, and it's a plaguey rough board here. Feeling of the knots and notches. But wait a bit, Grimshander. I've got a carpenter's plane there in the bar. But wait, I say, and I'll make this snug enough. So saying, he procured the plane, and with his old silk handkerchief, first dusting the bench, vigorously set to planing away at my bed, the wire grinned like an ace. The shavings flew right and left, till at last the plane iron came bump against an indestructible knot. The landlord was near spraining his wrist, and I told him, for heaven's sake, to quit. The bed was soft enough to suit me, and I did not know how all the planing in the world could make eiderdown of a pine plank. So, gathering up the shavings with another grin, and throwing them into the great stove in the middle of the room, he went about his business and left me in a brown study. I now took the measure of the bench and found it was a foot too short. But it was a foot too narrow, and the other bench in the room was about 4 inches higher than the bench, so there was no yoking in it. I then placed the first bench lengthwise along the only clear space against the wall, leaving a little room for my back to settle down. But I soon found that there came such a draft of cool air over the room by myself that this would never be at all, especially especially as another current from the rickety door met the one from the window, and both together formed a series of small whirlwinds in the immediate vicinity of the spot.
Four
He pays regular, was the rejoinder. But come, it's getting dreadful late. You had better be turning sheets. It's a nice bed. Sal and me slept in that air bed the night we were spliced. There's plenty of room for two to kick about in that bed. It's an almighty big bed, you had. Why, afore we'd give it up, Sal used to put our Sam and little Johnny in the foot of it. But I got a dreaming and sprawling about one night, and somehow Sam got pitched on the floor and came near breaking his arm. After that, Sal said he'd do. Come along here, I'll give you a glim in the jiffy. And so saying, he lighted a candle, offering to lead the way. But I stood irresolute. When looking at a clock in the corner, he exclaimed, "Long it's Sunday. You won't see that happen here tonight. He's come to anchor somewhere. Come along, then. Ooh, won't you come?" I considered the matter. And then upstairs we went, and I was ushered into a small room, spacious as a flat, and furnished, to be sure, with a prodigious bed, almost big enough, indeed, for any four harpooners to sleep abreast. Said the landlord, placing the candle on a crazy old sea chest, which played duty as a washstand and center table. "There, make yourself comfortable now, and good night to you." I turned from eye on the bed, but he had disappeared. Folding back the counterpane, I stooped over the bed. Though none of the most elegant, it yet stood the scrutiny tolerably well. I then glanced round the room, and besides the bedstead and center table, could see no other furniture belonging to the place, but a rude shelf, the four walls, and a paper fireboard representing him striking a whale. Of things not properly belonging to the room, there was a hammock lashed up and thrown upon the floor in one corner. Also a large seaman's bag containing a harpooner's wardrobe, no doubt in lieu of a land trunk. Likewise, there was a parcel of outlandish bone fish hooks on the shelf near the fireplace, and a tall harpooner standing at the head of the bed. But what is this on the chest? I took it up and held it close to the light and felt it and smelt it and tried every way possible to arrive at some satisfactory conclusion concerning it. I can compare it to nothing but a large doormat, ornamented at the edges with little tinkling tags, something like a stained pipe quilt round an Indian moccasin. There was a hole, or slit, in the middle of the mat, as you see the same in South get into the parade streets of any Christian town without sort of towns. I put it on to try it, and it weighed me down like a camera, uncommonly shaggy and thick, as though this mysterious I went up and looked at a bit of glass stuck against the wall, and I never saw such a sight in my life. I tore myself out of it in such a hurry that I gave myself a kick. I sat down on the side of the bed and was leaning like this, head pillowing high. After thinking so hard on the bedside, I got up and took off my little coat, and then stood in the middle of the bed and thought. I went to bed and felt like a mirror in my fortune. I was beginning to feel very cold. No more of you, but jump on and then blowing out the candle, I went to bed and commended myself to the care of heaven. Whether that mattress was stuffed with corn cobs or broken crockery, there is no telling. But I rolled about a good deal and could not sleep for a long time. At last, I slid on into a light doze, and had pretty nearly made a good offering towards the land of Nod when I heard heavy footsteps in the passage and saw a glimmer of light coming from the door. "Lord, save me," thought I. "That must be the heart in here, the infernal head pepper." But I lay perfectly still and resolved not to say a word till spoken to me. Holding a light in one hand, and that I think was his head in the other, the strength entered the room. and without looking towards the penetration, he was a good way off from me on the floor in one corner. Ned began working away at the knotted cords of the large bag I before spoke of. It was an eagerness to see that he was protected with the blanket for some time while employed in unlacing the bag. This accomplished, however, he turned around. When? Good heavens, what a sight! It was of a dark purplish-yellow color, pure, stuck over with large, blackish-looking squares. He's a terrible bedfellow. He's been in a fight, but dreadfully cut, and here he is, just from the surgeon. But at that moment, he chanced to turn his face so towards the light that I plainly saw they could not be sticking plasters at all, those black squares on his cheeks. They were stains of some sort or other. At first I knew not what to make of this, but soon an inkling of the truth occurred to me. I remembered the story of a white man, a wellman too, who, fallen among the cannibals, had been tattooed by me. I concluded that this harpooner, in the course of his distant voyages, must have met with a similar adventure. And what is it, thought I after all? It's only his outside. A man can be honest in any sort of skin. But then what to make of this unearthly complexion? That part of it, I mean, lying round about and completely independent of the squares of tattoo. To be sure, it might be nothing but a good coat of tropical tanning. But I never heard of a hot sun's tanning a white man into a purplish yellow one. However, I had never been in the South Seas, and perhaps the sun there produced these extraordinary effects upon the skin. Now, all these ideas were passing through me like